Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Mark Swerdlin on behalf of petitioners Asher Candy, Inc. and Sherwood Brands, Inc. For the reasons addressed in our papers, we submit that Asher was not liable for severance payments to approximately 47 employees who were terminated upon the 2004 closure of Asher's New York plant, and that Asher did not fail to provide the union with adequate notice of the closure or an opportunity to bargain over the effects of that closure.
When did the union receive constructive notice or actual notice of the closure?
The union was receiving at least constructive notice of the closure for a several-year period, frankly.
In what form?
Well, the company, once Sherwood Brands acquired Asher Candy in 2002, and Sherwood continued to honor the existing collective bargaining agreement that had a term until June 30th of 2002, in the fall, the operations were seasonal, so the employees would come on in the spring, work through the fall because they were producing candy canes. After the fall production in 2002, when Sherwood's already on the scene as the corporate owner, Sherwood had made the decision to start closing down, in that instance, the third shift, and began to move production to facilities in Brazil. The union was well aware of that because the company had permanently laid off employees after 2002.
So the shutting down of the third shift put them on notice that someday the whole plant would be shuttered?
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that that began the process. The next year, when the seasonal layoff occurred in 2003, the company again, at that point, shut down the second shift and continued to move production to Brazil, to suppliers in Brazil. The union knew this was taking place because not only had a Brazilian company come to the facility in New Hyde Park, New York, to start taking down dismantling machinery.
The second shift, where was the constructive notice that the plant itself was going to be shuttered? Were there any discussions between the company and the union regarding that?
Well, after, Your Honor, after the second shift and the production again moving to Brazil, and in fact, union employees had gone to Brazil after that second shift closed down to help train the personnel in Brazil to run the machinery. Then we come to 2004, and the company again has the layoffs in October of 2004, and at that time decides to close down the plant in total, which there were some cleanup operations, so the last few people left the door in February of 2005. It was in October and November of 2004 that the company had communicated to the union that the plant would be shut down in total at that point.
What day did they communicate that to them?
I believe the day would have been October the 29th. There was a communication from the plant.
When did the board make the decision to shut the plant, and then how long after that did they give notice to the union?
The record evidence does not indicate what date the board of Sherwood made the decision to close the plant. The facility was, as I said, closed in after they shut down operations the end of 2004 and had to clean up, you know, until the beginning of 2005. And there were communications between the Asher HR official, Ms. Juanita Gillis, to the union confirming that the plant was being shut down, and communications from a Mr. Jim Spampinato, who was the general manager of the Asher facility in New York, not a Sherwood official, who had also had communications with the union rep by the name of Ray Aquilino. Now, Asher Candy had had several owners from that period in the 1980s when it began operations until 2002. Sherwood, as I mentioned, which is based and headquartered in Rockville, Maryland, purchased Asher in April of 2002. Sherwood is a publicly traded holding company of independently managed subsidiaries that manufacture, market, and distribute a variety of cookies, candies, chocolates, other confectionery items. And during the relevant period, the Sherwood had five wholly owned subsidiaries, each of which was separately incorporated and separately run. Now, Sherwood had a five-member board, which included Mr. Uziel Friedman, who was the chairman, president, and CEO, who also became the president of Asher Candy. There were three independent members on that five-member board. When Sherwood acquired Asher in 2002, it took on significant debt that Asher had acquired, and Sherwood was required to make up the delinquent union dues and pension payments. I mentioned Mr. Spampinato. He had been president, CEO, and part owner of Asher, and following Sherwood's purchase, he continued only as the general manager of Sherwood. Now, there was a collective bargaining agreement, as I mentioned, that ran from 1999 to June 30th of 2002. When Sherwood came on the scene in April of 2002, it continued to honor the terms of that collective bargaining agreement until its expiration. The parties mutually agreed to extend that contract by 30 days through the end of July of 2002. There were negotiations in June and July between Mr. Spampinato, again the Asher general manager, and the union. Those negotiations lasted over 4 days, and ultimately a memorandum of agreement was reached between Asher and the union. Principally and significant here is that Mr. Spampinato was the negotiator for Asher Candy. At one session, an individual by the name of Christopher Willey, who was a CFO for both Sherwood and Asher, happened to be at the plant on an unrelated matter that day, and he sat in on the negotiations. He was not a negotiator. He did not sign the memorandum of agreement. The memorandum covered just 5 points, wage increases, rest periods, and bonuses. It did not cover the severance term. It did not provide significantly that the remainder of the collective bargaining agreement, which had expired now as of July of 2002, would continue in force and effect. Asher, thereafter, after the signing of the memorandum of agreement, continued to comply with the terms set forth in the MOA. And it was Asher's understanding that those were the only terms that were still operative between the companies. Towards the end of 2002, Mr. Aquilino came to Asher and asked Asher to sign a full-blown collective bargaining agreement that would have incorporated the terms of the MOA and the prior collective bargaining terms. Asher did not sign that agreement. Mr. Aquilino came back the next year asking again for an individual to sign the agreement. Eventually, in 2004, even asked Mr. Friedman, when he came to the plant for the first time since Sherwood had acquired the company, asked Mr. Friedman to sign it. And all those occasions, it was never signed. And we believe significant, the union never filed an unfair labor practice charge alleging that the company, meaning Asher, had violated the National Labor Relations Act in not signing an agreement that had allegedly been reached between the parties.
But under Honeywell International, wasn't its severance right protected?
Well, the key issue would be whether or not there was a mutual understanding that those terms continued. And we submit that because Mr. Aquilino... Yes, Your Honor, it is a mandatory subject of bargaining.
And it was part of the collective bargaining agreement?
Yes, it was part of the 99-2002 bargaining agreement.
There was no finding of an impasse.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So aren't you obligated under Honeywell International?
The company's position is that the parties reached the agreement on the MOA. The MOA did not, as many MOAs say, in the field of labor relations, they specifically reference that the terms and conditions of the existing collective bargaining agreement continue along with these maybe minor or substantial revisions.
But they don't have to say that, do they? They don't have to have those expressed terms. And in fact, the memorandum of agreement, in effect, references the collective bargaining agreement by talking about an increase of certain wages, right? There's nothing in the memorandum of agreement that expressly says it's displacing the collective bargaining agreement. You'll agree to that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it becomes a matter of interpretation whether, fairly read, the memorandum of agreement could be seen as superseding the collective bargaining agreement, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's your only way out from under Honeywell.
Yes, Your Honor. And as I said, the fact that the parties did not expressly agree to continue the rest of the terms, the fact that the company did change some items going forward with respect to how it dealt with the employees, some items that were in the prior collective bargaining agreement. And I think what's incredibly significant is the fact that Mr. Aquilino himself came to the company, meaning Mr. Spampinato, the Asher general manager, and asked for Mr. Spampinato to sign that agreement. And as I mentioned a few moments ago, Mr. Spampinato is the one who signed the memorandum of agreement. There is no record evidence that the Sherwood Board of Directors either approved the MOA or signed the MOA, or even were asked to sign the MOA. So again, we submit that because Asher's understanding, and there has to be two parties to agree to the terms of an agreement here, Asher's understanding is frankly confirmed by the fact that Mr. Aquilino felt the need to come to Asher in 2002, late in 2003, and even 2004, and asked for the agreement to be signed. And when Mr. Aquilino did that, and it was that
agreement proposed?
It was placed in evidence, Your Honor, and the proposed...
Are the terms identical to the former collective bargaining agreement?
They are, except for the changes based on the five-point MOA. But again, the fact is the company refused, that is clear, the company refused to sign, and it's also clear that Mr. Aquilino or the union never filed a grievance or an unfair labor practice charge.
So is the company's refusal to sign sufficient to show impasse?
Well, we would submit that it's sufficient to show that there was no meeting of the minds on that point. And had Mr. Aquilino believed that the parties had, in fact, reached agreement, he should have filed either a grievance or a ULP.
And the answer to my question is?
There was no record evidence that there were discussions at the sessions for the MOA on any of the other terms besides the five terms that were agreed to. So there's no record evidence that there was impasse on any term. The only evidence is that there was agreement on five specific terms that made its way to a piece of paper signed by Mr. Spampinato and union representatives. We believe that the surrounding evidence, and again, that Mr. Aquilino's efforts to get that agreement signed, and for whatever reason not to file a grievance or a ULP, are evidence that the parties knew that the severance was not agreed to. And when I was referring back to the prior shutdown of the third shift, the second shift, in response to your question about notice to the union, we submit further that this continues to demonstrate that the union was well aware that the company did not believe it had any severance obligations, because a reading of the collective bargaining agreement, the expired collective bargaining agreement, and specifically page 277 of the joint appendix, shows that if the company were to shut down a portion of the facility and, in essence, subcontract it out, which is what was being done here, the contract would provide for severance payments pursuant to Article 23, which is the article that is at issue in this case. Again, the union never made a demand to the company after the second and third shift shutdowns severance.
Let me ask you, you say that there's no record evidence as to when the company decided to shut down Asher.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Who bears the burden on that one? On that point of evidence?
I'm not sure that I understand why the
why
date of when...
Relevant? Well, I mean, you're saying waiver of effects bargaining, and Judge Griffith had a series of questions about when was the union notified. And key on effects bargaining is when was the decision made to close down the plant. And there's no evidence that would support your argument of waiver.
Your Honor, the record evidence shows the decision was made clearly sometime before October 29th when Ms. Gillis, the Asher HR official, confirmed that to the union that the plant was in fact closing down for good. We are submitting through our papers and through the argument here today that there was a continuing notice to the union that this plant was going to be going away with the second and third shift shutdowns, with the transfer of production to Brazil, the fact that union bargaining unit employees actually went to Brazil to help train the new supplier on the machinery, and the machinery being taken away from the facility was not done under the dark of night. It was done in full view of all the employees. So
your point is, as I understand it, that the board could have found on this record that the union knew or should have known that the employer that Sherwood was moving toward closing down the Asher plant permanently?
Yes, Your Honor.
But the board didn't find that.
No, it didn't, Your Honor.
And why isn't there sufficient evidence to support the board's contrary finding?
We don't believe there's sufficient evidence because there's no refutation of the course of conduct that I've laid out here and in our papers about the closing of the third and second shifts, the moving of the machinery, the training of the personnel in Brazil to operate the new machine, the machinery that's been moved down to Brazil, and the fact that when...
I thought there was evidence that the union was told that when some of these shifts were shut down, like the second shift, that the employees would be recalled.
Mr. Aquilino testified to that, the union rep, but I'm not aware of any confirming evidence that would credit that testimony.
Well, was there any contrary evidence?
The contrary evidence is that the size of the workforce went from approximately 180 people when Sherwood acquired it to 120 in 2002 to 60 or so in 03, and then down to zero when it closed. So Mr. Aquilino's testimony that he was told one thing doesn't mesh with the facts that these people were gone and that the jobs were permanently gone, again, leading to our argument with respect to the waiver. I know that I'm just about into my rebuttal. I just wanted to make one final point on this, which is that the cases are clear that there doesn't have to be a significant period of time to engage in meaningful effects bargaining. And we would submit that even with the notice, assuming it was as late as October 29th, that there was still sufficient time to engage in appropriate effects bargaining under the Act. There was, in fact, bargaining that took place after October 29th.
I think we have your argument. Your time has expired.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, my name is David Fleischer, representing the National Labor Relations Board. On the main argument made by my opponent, I would note that the record doesn't show that the employees saw machinery actually being dismantled and removed. And certainly there is.
What's the remedy, Mr. Fleischer, for the remedy for the severance failure to pay the severance pay is pay the money.
Yes.
But the remedy for not bargaining in good faith over the closing of the plant, what's the remedy for that?
Well, it's over the effects, not the closing itself.
Yeah.
But
What's the remedy
is to bargain on request, and I would point out that the effect goes beyond severance pay. It would have included issues such as possible transfer of the employees to other plants, especially if, as we contend, Sherwood was Sherwood and Asher were a single employer, so that transfer to other Sherwood plants would be an appropriate subject for bargaining, in effect. The employer claims that simply the fact that one shift at a time was discontinued, it was sufficient notice that the whole plant was going to be closed. We submit it's not, especially since Mr. Aquilino did testify that he was told that when production, as to the second shift especially, when it was laid off at the end of 2003, it's important to note this was a seasonal business, and every year the employees were laid off during the fall when business went down. And his testimony was that he was told that when business picked back up again, the employees would be recalled. No one from Asher or Sherwood was called to testify to the contrary. And the fact that the employees the following spring weren't recalled is hardly noticed that the whole plant's going down. At most, it's noticed that either business hasn't picked up because the union obviously isn't privy to the volume of business that the company is doing, or even at most it might be noticed that the second shift is gone and that the company henceforth is going to operate on one shift. But operating on one shift isn't the same as not operating at all in the future. And I would point out that as far as severance pay is concerned, the way the expired contract reads, the severance pay provision says that the company has to either shut down entirely or move beyond commuting distance before anyone's entitled to severance pay. There's nothing in there that allows employees on one shift to get severance pay if the one shift is shut down. And so the union had no reason to bargain over severance pay each time a shift was shut down. I would add that in response to one of Judge Rogers' questions, who has the burden of proof that waiver is clearly an affirmative defense, and in our opinion, the burden of proof, therefore, is on the party asserting waiver. I would also like to discuss briefly the single employer question, because we submit that the company's brief, in effect, tries to impose a standard that the case law doesn't justify, which is basically that single employer has to be to meet the standards for alter ego. The Supreme Court in Dina Artware clearly distinguished between the two. Alter ego typically, although not invariably, involves the creation of a new corporation to evade either an existing contract or an existing board or court order. We admit that none of that is shown here, but it doesn't have to be for single employer, because that's a different legal concept involving lesser requirements. What it requires is control by the parent, not over every detail of day-to-day operations, but over the major policy decisions. And although potential control isn't enough, because that exists whenever there's ownership, proof that they actually exercise control is highly significant. And in this case, the record shows that Sherwood did exercise control over all of the critical actions that occurred in this case. Sherwood decided to close the plant. Sherwood decided not to pay severance pay. With regard to the memorandum of agreement, Uziel Friedman, Sherwood's CEO, testified it had to have his approval and then the board of directors' approval to be effective as a contract. The record shows that Sherwood processed the Asher employees' paychecks. The actual checks they received were Asher checks, but the checks would bounce unless Sherwood funded them. We would submit that all this is ample proof of single employer status. We would also note that Sherwood itself told the SEC that Asher employees were its employees. The Asher facility was its facility. Its website told all the customers that the Asher products were its products. We would submit the board is entitled to take it at its word. Further on, to go back, if I may, to the severance issue and the effects bargaining issue, the first clear notice the union had of closing was October 29th. That was the day that the plant was indeed shut down as far as any production was concerned. All the employees were laid off except four who stayed on to clean up and help move out the machinery. We would submit that the notice to the union when the bargaining unit is reduced to four is not the same as notice when there's a viable 45-person unit, the difference in the union's ability to bargain meaningfully is quite obvious. If there are no further questions, I will otherwise stand on our brief.
Thank you, Mr. Bush. I believe your time's expired. We'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a brief point. With regard to the remedy issue about transferring the employees to other plants, no other facilities within the Sherwood umbrella of companies were unionized, so I don't think that's viable. There was discussion about the fact that...
Why isn't it viable? I don't understand that. You have a job, but you won't be a member of a union.
Well, it would be rather difficult in order to try to transfer bargaining unit employees and discussing that with the union to transfer them to facilities that are not organized or represented by collective bargaining relationships. I suppose if there's a job open, maybe somebody could go take it, but it wouldn't necessarily be through the union. The fact that the one shift shutting down, not being eligible for severance, that the board has argued, I believe that the language of it, at page 277 of the joint appendix, indicates that that's not true, that the language would provide for severance and the union supplements rights. And with regard to the single employer, which again,
I didn't get the last part sorry, of the sentence.
I believe the union
277 would show what?
Would show that when there's a shutdown of one shift, that there would be grounds for severance and the union didn't seek it. I believe my time is up.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.